Once more unto the breach, dear friends, else close the wall up with our English dead. This is Jake McClure at the Personal Wealth Coach, the program you're listening to. If you'd like to call in and join with me and add another voice to the conversation, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400. And I ended last hour still not having finished the concept of money. It's a big concept, and it takes a lot of data to get right. And I've got a call coming in on 773-1400, so caller, go ahead. You're on the Personal Wealth Coach.
Hello?
Hello. You're on the air.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. And what is a stretch Roth IRA?
Okay.
Number one. Number two, can it be used instead of a generational trust? Number three, what is the financial advantage to me for setting up a charitable trust? Those are the three questions. Thank you.
All right. Those three questions are good questions. Don't get me wrong there. The stretch Roth IRA. The Roth doesn't meet the same standards for stretch that a traditional IRA does. So what is a stretch? When you have a traditional IRA, it means you put money in there and you've had it deducted from your income. You haven't paid taxes on it, so it's sitting there. And at the person's death who put it in there, their heirs, if it's not the spouse, have to treat it a specific way, in that they have to take the money out or over a choice that the government gives them of a certain period of time so that they pay the taxes on it. If somebody's already been taking the required minimum distributions out, then those required minimum distributions have to be keep going for the heir, the beneficiary. A stretch is kind of a term that's used for a lot of things. It means to take it out over a long period of time, over a stretch. And it's been given some technical meanings in traditional IRAs. With a Roth IRA, it's not the same because the taxes aren't due on those. The government doesn't mandate that you take it out over a given period of time. You get to take it out when you take it out. It's already had taxes paid on it. It's not going to have taxes due on it. That's not counting estate taxes. The regulatory issues get really thick here. So the concept there of a stretch Roth IRA doesn't make sense in the normal sense of a stretch IRA, because you can take it out when you want. But you can make your own stretch. You can say, I'm going to take it out over a given period of time. Okay, so what's a charitable trust and why should you use it? These are very specific questions, and I suspect they have a specific meaning in the questioner's life. A charitable trust, there's a couple of things that can be thought of here. There's charitable remainder trusts and there's charitable trusts. Those are different entities. A charitable trust is similar in a lot of ways to a foundation. It means it's not for profit. Its idea is the money goes into the trust to be used for charitable purposes. Charitable remainder trust is something you put money in while you're alive that you can use while you're alive to some extent and then hand it off to a charity, a church, a school, some form of nonprofit organization that's community-based, or even to like Doctors Without Borders. So there's differences there across the board, and first and foremost, if you have true questions about trusts, you need to talk to an attorney, and you need to talk to an attorney that deals with trusts. You should vet them the same way you would vet anybody else. You need to go through the process of making sure that they're the person you want to trust with your advice or their advice to you. But trusts become complicated almost immediately. I have spent several previous episodes talking at length about the regulatory environment in the financial world. It's not just the banks or the financial institutions that have this to bear. It's when you're talking about how's the best way to take Social Security. It's when you're talking about what kind of trusts are out there and what's the right one for you. Because there are dozens of types of trust. And the fact that you ask what's a charitable trust could mean three or four different kinds of trusts. So finding somebody to ask that of specifically to your circumstances, instead of getting an education of the illogic of the regulatory environment, you're going to get a specific answer based on your needs. A fiduciary investment advisor may be able to help you with some of that, but they're not, unless they're also attorneys, are not supposed to be giving legal advice. They may give you some education on what trusts are and tell you to go to an attorney. An attorney should give you some education on the appropriate trust for you, if you even need a trust, and so on. And I'm sorry, I forgot the third question. I didn't write them all down. I felt pretty happy about remembering the two that I did. All right. So if you'd like to call back in to get that third question, hopefully I hit the other two in a way that was good for you. It's a complicated world that we live in. So the number in here is 254-773-1400. Back to money. Our system is based in confidence. Your belief that money has value causes money to have value. This is true and has been tested to be true. In Brazil, there was a group of four or five economists that were trained in the United States. This was about 15 years ago. And Brazil at the time had runaway inflation, double digits, way runaway inflation every year. And this team, this group of economists, proposed something pretty novel to the Brazilian government, to the executive branch of the Brazilian government. They said, we're going to make a imaginary currency, truly imaginary. It doesn't exist except in our minds. But we're going to mark that currency every day with the value of that currency, and it's going to go up and down with market conditions, but we're going to help stabilize it. So what good could that possibly do? Well, one of the requirements that the government did was it required for every price tag in the store to show the price in the new emergency or emerging imaginary currency and the old currency. And the nature of that kind of inflation is those price tags got changed every day because the prices had to change every day for the business to stay profitable because inflation was so high. The shoppers would look at the price tag and they would see the current currency, the real, going through the stratosphere as far as the inflation rate goes. So the price is climbing and climbing and climbing every day. And the price underneath it in the new imaginary real, which is kind of funny that it's real imaginary real. I find that humorous anyway. The imaginary real was very stable. And they did that for a year. They required all the businesses to put those double price tags on everything. At the end of the year, they replaced the old real with a new one. The imaginary one became the real one, the real real. And their inflation stopped. Think about that for a second. They had runaway inflation, and the only thing they changed was the mode of payment. It had new pictures on it. It had new everything as far as the look for it. It was the same size and shape. But the most important aspect of it is that it had the confidence of the entire market in its stability. It hadn't been going up in value like crazy. One of the things that happens that causes inflation to get runaway, to leave behind all reality and just go nuts, is that if you see prices going up every day, you have a tendency to want to buy more today so that you don't have to pay more tomorrow. The prices are going up, so I'm going to stock up on this today. Well, that lowers the available supply to the next person who wants to stock up on that thing today. In the United States, after the current president was elected and for basically the majority of his terms in office, you could see that happen to ammunition for guns. the price of ammunition went through the stratosphere because there's just not enough of it for everybody that wanted to stock up just in case Obama came to take the guns. So the price went through the stratosphere, and then the rumors started going around that the prices were going up because the government didn't like the ammo and they were putting some kind of extra fee on it. And it was totally a market-driven environment. But the confidence that maybe Obama was changing the price caused more people to go out and buy it. That's an inflationary environment. It was an inflationary environment on the price of ammunition at the same time that we had deflationary environments for the rest of our economy. We had a pretty stable, slight deflationary trend during a large part of his administration. Confidence is vital. If you believe in the strength of our currency, and people, even when they say they don't, they do believe in the strength. The reason why I can say that with assurance is that the same people that say, I think the dollar is going to implode, when I say, are you going to use something else to buy your things with, they say no. And I say, why not? And they said, well, you can't buy with anything else. Well, that means if you haven't tried, your confidence still has to be there, even if it's a mandatory thing. And you can go into a barter economy. You can create your own little barter economy, and that happens. I mean, the Internal Revenue Service, the IRS, is well known for its taxation on traded services between business owners. Barter happens. It is another form of currency, and yet when you go out to buy a big new flat-screen TV, the same people who said, all right, I have to use it, well, that doesn't mean that they're confident in the currency. That's not, you know, it just means they have to use it. Well, then I say, are you planning on buying something like a flat-screen television? Or if you were planning on buying the flat-screen television, when would you buy it? And they kind of say, well, I am planning on doing that, and I'm planning on buying it next time they go on sale, or Black Friday, or the day after Christmas. All those statements mean that they're confident in the currency. The mandatory aspect aside, they're waiting to use the currency because they expect prices to go down later. They expect the currency to be able to buy more value later. That's a judgment about their confidence in the currency. And the act of doing that gives the currency more value. It's all of us doing that that causes the currency to become stronger. Stronger is not necessarily a good thing. And if you have a doubt about that, next time you go to get a massage done, think about having a bodybuilder give it to you. For me, that's a nightmare. For some people, they might like it. Strength in currency is a danger in that if our currency gets too strong, people won't buy from us because our prices will get too high in their currency. So a good balance of strength and resilience is necessary in currency. So why am I talking about all of this? I've talked about how money's made, how it disappears, what it used to be. I'm talking about this because the current administration, the Obama administration's Justice Department, just issued a big statement against Deutsche Bank that said that during the recession, during the horrible downturn and the things leading up to it, Deutsche Bank contributed to that. And in contributing to that, they somehow, and this is where the Justice Department hasn't been clear, they somehow massively contributed to the downturn enough that they owe $14 billion, with a B, to the Justice Department. In order to get those damages, I think it's a pretty basic assumption that you need to say what they're from. What was the thing that caused that damage? And second, in the middle of it, to have the damages be proportional to the damages done by the bank. I'm bringing this up because Deutsche Bank, which is one of the 11 largest banks in the world, it's a German bank, it's worth on the market about $17.9 billion. billion B. The fine from the Justice Department that they're saying they want is $14.1 billion. They're basically saying, give us your company. And it's causing a run on the bank. It's causing the euro to be shaky. It's politically oriented. This is election season, and people say I'm a big Obama supporter. Well, that's just because they are not Obama supporters. I tend to give my judgment on each decision rather than on the person making the decision. Now, if they have a track record of making bad decisions, I tend to say, hey, I'm not sure at the beginning if I like this decision, let me read into it. And Barack Obama has made some good decisions and some bad decisions. He's not a good leader, but he's made good decisions and bad decisions, both in the international world and politically at home. He's had successes, and by that, success means that you made decisions that were good in light of what your needs were, good in light of the American economy, even. Some of the good decisions, if you, people out there are doubting me, well, Obama never made a good decision. When he took over office, he kept the same Secretary of Defense that George W. Bush had. That's pretty unusual. That's a seamless transition because we were in the middle of a war. He didn't have to do that. He's anti-war. He could have come in with a new Secretary of Defense. He gets to choose his cabinet. He doesn't have another president choose the cabinet he's going to take. That's a good decision in my mind. And it's one. It was one of his first decisions. The decision he's making on having the Justice Department say this about Deutsche Bank is stupid. Because what he's done is put the euro currency in danger at a time when they've got threats from the East. Not a good idea. And he's doing it based on politics. Not cool. The Justice Department might say that they didn't have any influence from the executive branch, but that's not true, because the executive branch right now and the legislative branch, it's Republicans as well, are all crowding on to point fingers at the banks. Before you do that too much, recognize that the banks owe us all money. We owe them money, but they owe us more money than we owe them. It's across the board. Because they can't make loans unless they have the deposits. Those deposits they owe to us. That's their debt to us. If we penalize them too hard, and the idea of penalizing a bank for the vast majority of its value on the market causes lack of confidence in that bank. It causes people to go to that bank and want to remove their money just in case it's not there. Enough people do that, the confidence in that bank is shattered, and in the currency may be shattered. That was a really, really short-sighted and stupid decision by the Justice Department. There's a rumor that they've rephrased it and they say it's more like $5 billion that they're requesting. Deutsche Bank happens to have a settlement fund that they've been building since the Great Recession that amounts to about the same amount of money. If it was a negotiation tactic, if they were saying we're going to hit you with a big fine and then settle for less, you don't do that to banks. If the Federal Reserve were doing that to one of our banks, it would cause the bank to fail. The Justice Department needs to understand that banks have to hold confidence or they fail, and then everybody that's loaned them money and read into that made deposits at their bank will lose their assets. And it requires the insurance paid for by the governments and the other banks to kick in and do that. There's no good that comes out of it. If they have a real damage, and they do, I mean, the Deutsche Bank did a lot of bad loan practices, and we did a lot of them in the United States. A lot of banks here did bad loan practices, and they've been hit by big fines. But none of the fines were big enough to put the company out of business. If Deutsche Bank goes down, it can do the same thing that we warned about at the beginning of the Great Recession. You knock over a big bank, all the banks that are owed money by that bank could fail. You have to be careful. We have not fixed the too big to fail thing. We kind of put it behind us and behind our the back of our minds, or even gone out of most of our minds. Too big to fail is still a massive issue. So the nature of money, it's not just supply and demand, it's also confidence. When you're talking about the nature of money that's backed by gold or silver or cowrie shells or salt or flint. You're talking about supply and demand, period. When you're dealing with currency, you've got the supply of the currency, which is semi-regulated by the banks on how many loans they give out, how much profits they make. It's regulated by you and I and how many loans we want to take at a given time and how much we want to pay for those loans. But the confidence factor, because it's backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government, faith and credit are confidence. And if we lose that, or the Europeans lose the faith in the Eurozone, in their currency, it does not have good impact on our economy, period. It's bad for us. Banks need to be held accountable. And last week I talked about Wells Fargo and the stupidity that was going on there and how they absolutely needed to be fined. But where does that money go? If the money is going to the government so that they can do education, by that we mean public service announcements on the radio, probably not the best use of the money. If the $14 billion fine levied against Deutsche Bank, if they paid that fine, where does it go? Well, it's not going to the people that were damaged by bad loans. It's going to the U.S. government. That's not what we want. If there's damages that are requiring a punitive fine, that fine should be delivered to the people that were damaged, not the Justice Department, not the U.S. government. We all can agree that Deutsche Bank did some bad things, just like a lot of the banks in the United States, just like a lot of the banks in the rest of Europe and China and everywhere else. Those banks got caught up in a frenzy of stupidity, making loans to people that couldn't pay for them and then selling those loans to other banks who were doing the same thing and selling them to them, and they each thought that they were the only ones doing it. It's pretty short-sighted. Well, the current administration is being short-sighted in its response. One, and kind of vital in this, is it's almost 9 years after the fact. You don't wait a decade to fine someone for something they did. And then you don't wait a decade and hit them with a fine that's completely out of proportion to the damages, particularly if that fine's going to hurt the very people who were damaged in those loans. Because a lot of the people that were damaged in the loans still have loans, still have deposits at Deutsche Bank. Deutsche Bank. To destroy Deutsche Bank is to destroy the deposits of the very people who were damaged. That is the reason that we're destroying Deutsche Bank. That is like using the death penalty for jaywalking. And then going out and finding everybody on the street corner who watched it happen and getting them too. This is not the way regulatory environments should work with banks. It needs to have clear thought, rational decisions, balancing the damages done and the costs of those damages, and then recompensating the people who lost out of it, not a big money grab from the banks to the government. That just doesn't make any sense. All right, I've got to play some commercials. I'll be back in a bit. If you'd like to join in the conversation, the phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400. And we got a couple of commercials to play, hopefully not too many this hour. Then we'll be back with more good news. There's the GDP numbers are coming in. We've got lots of stuff good in the economy. There's some bad things in the economy we need to be aware of, and I'll give warnings on those areas. And until I come back, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
I'm Sally, a volunteer at United Way.
And I'm back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400. I was talking about Deutsche Bank, talking about the bad decision by the current administration and the Justice Department in going after them with a fine that was completely unreasonable in a way that could make the bank completely fail and take down a bunch of other banks with it. Not brilliant. The fine's important. Getting them to pay the damages that they owe is important. Why we waited 8 years or 9 years to do it. It's a good question. Why we're doing it in the middle of a political season? Good question. Why we're doing an exorbitant amount of money not related to the damages? Another good question. It looks political, and it's the kind of politics that can cause allies to stop being allies. Now, that's not the response that the German public is having. The German public is very embarrassed. They don't like the idea that one of their major banks caused damages to the rest of the world during the Great Recession. They don't like it at all. So they are talking about not allowing state aid if the bank fails in the event this fine is paid. If they don't prop it up, and this is what I was saying not that long ago, we're not done with the too big to fail thing yet. We haven't really fixed that. By really fixed that, we haven't fixed it at all. In fact, we've concentrated more. We have more too big to fails today than we did at the beginning of the Great Recession. Now we have greater requirements on how they maintain themselves, and we have greater regulations on making sure they have reserves on hand, but they still make mistakes. We have to be careful, and if Bank of America or any of the other banks, any bank, has a big loan out to Deutsche Bank and Deutsche Bank fails, then that's money they don't get back. If deposits are there and maybe the insurance covers the deposits, well, we can hope for that. They don't have the FDIC. They have a German equivalent of that. But it's not a good thing to cause a bank who's holding the investments and the assets of a lot of people to disappear 9 years after they violated something and with no relation to the crime, to the punishment. All right, so there's Deutsche Bank. Now, since I'm on the subject of banks, let's talk about Wells Fargo. I mentioned them in passing. They really stupid stuff they did. There were some semi-low-level employees that put a bunch of extra products in their customers' positions. So if you had two bank accounts, you may have suddenly had three accounts, not even known it. Most of the people who had these extra products given to them were not damaged, but some of them were, because sometimes you have to take money out of one account to open another account, and that can cause checks to bounce. It can cause debit cards to not work. It can cause a great deal of confusion. Those damages have been paid back to the customers by Wells Fargo, mostly, hopefully. They need to go through and thoroughly research everybody that was damaged and make sure they're paid back. The government's coming in and saying, we want some of that money too. You messed up. Give us $185 million. That's M, not B, million. That's proportional to the crime. Now, why the government gets it instead of the damaged people, I don't understand. I think that's a little bit silly. I think it'd be a good use of the money to give it to the people. It would cause them to be even more vigilant when banks are doing bad things, because there's some incentive to say, hey, the bank messed up and overcharged me. Are they doing it to a lot of people? Maybe I can get paid for saying this. When the government does it and the government gets paid to do it, it means the government's looking for ways to get paid, not necessarily ways to help people that are being damaged. We need to separate the incentive from the enforcement of the law. If you're only incentivized as a department or the police, it doesn't matter, the fire department, if they're only given pay to fight certain fires, then those are the fires they're going to fight first. That's a priority that we all understand deep down. If you're paid to do something and not paid to do the other thing, you're more likely to do the thing you're paid to do. That's not, again, we're talking rocket surgery here. It's not rocket surgery. And I've had some people ask about what rocket surgery is. I'm going to leave that to your imagination. It's better than trying to give a definition. So what's a good response to Wells Fargo's perfidy? They're jumping in and taking money out of other people's accounts and using it the way they want so that their employees can get a better bonus. Well, there's some really, really good things you can do. You cannot use Wells Fargo for your banking. That's a simple thing. If they have a habit of scamming their customers. It was just a good market-driven response is to say, I'm not going to be your customer anymore. And the state of Illinois just suspended Wells Fargo from bonds for Illinois bonds. And Wells Fargo may be pretty happy about that, actually, because Illinois' bonds are not looking very good right now. But the concept of what Illinois is doing and saying, hey, if you're scamming your customers, you're not the kind of quality we want to use to do our bonds. At some point, they may revisit that because it's not a permanent answer to an activity that they... This is the other side of the story for Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo are the ones that announced to the world that the scam had happened. They're the ones that already fired over 5,000 people for doing the scam. Now, just because they blew the whistle on themselves doesn't mean that they don't get punished. Don't get me wrong there. But they came out to the public and said, hey, we just did something stupid. We're fixing it. And the shareholders are removing bonuses from people in charge. The chief financial officer and the CEO are losing significant amount of money. It looks like most of the fine to the U.S. government, it may be coming out of this year's paycheck for them. When you think of that $185 million and most of that coming out of two paychecks, it's not a very big fine. Either that or they're being paid a lot of money. And in this case, that's a good point. I realize that's kind of a free flow, but I'm going to hit this because I get a lot of that. The classism that comes with they make more money than I do, so they should have less money because they were in charge when things went bad. First off, the amount of pay that CEOs get is high compared to the amount of pay that a teacher gets. A teacher may be in charge of an overly large classroom. Think 31 students. That's a lot of work for a teacher. Their compensation hasn't gone up with the class size, and we can complain about that. We can say, how do we get them paid more? But I don't want to pay more taxes, and how do we fix the system? The CEO of a major corporation has to be in charge of many thousands of people. It's a complex job, and there aren't that many people with the skill set to do it. And some of them are really good at it. Some of them are not. The ones that are not good at it need not to be doing it, and the market's pretty good at replacing them. The market is you and me. If we're a shareholder at Wells Fargo or any place else and we vote with our shares, the board members are interested in making sure that you keep wanting to put money there. So they're going to punish people who they hired for not catching this sooner. That's cool. Illinois coming in and saying, we're not going to allow you to issue any of our bonds. Very cool. Again, Wells Fargo may be happy with that because Illinois' bonds are not very quality right now. All right, so I've got some more commercials to play. I'll come back on the other side. I'm talking about banks and debt. I want to talk a little bit about China. I want to talk about the GDP. There's a lot to talk about, but if you'd like to join in, the phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400. And I'm going to play some commercials, and I'll be back on the other end with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. I'll be back. And I'm back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number in here is 254-773-1400. I'm going to take a minute and address a commercial. I didn't get chanced last hour because it was played too late, but there's a commercial that I've warned the folks at Town Square that if it's ever played on our program, I'm going to talk badly about it. There is a commercial on there that basically says, wealth without risk, you won't ever lose money ever, and you'll make huge amounts of money. The concept behind that commercial is based in insurance. People get paid a lot of money in commissions for it. The people that are doing the advertisement are selling a book because they've been removed forcibly by the regulators from the insurance industry. They sell a book that tells you how to give money to an insurance sales group that is associated with them, that they then get lots of money. Be careful. Do your research. Anyone who offers you wealth without risk is lying. Even the lottery. The risk is you don't win. There is no such thing as wealth without risk. Somebody risked to get that wealth. It's a given. It is a principle of money, and everybody that's listening knows that already. We still get scammed. We still get told, hey, you can do it this way. It's a secret nobody's ever told you about. Well, research it. If it's a secret that nobody else knows about because only the rich do it, why is it being advertised on the radio? It's not a secret if it's being advertised on the radio. It's not a secret if it's on late night commercial. Keep that in mind. Do your research. The environment for insurance and for most investing is buyer beware. That means you are the buyer. You should beware. Do your research. The reason why mutual fund commercials are required to say at the end of it, read prospectus carefully before investing, isn't because the prospectus is full of all of the marketing that you will ever need to know about how wonderful their company is. No, it's because it tells you what the fees and expenses internal of. It tells you what you should expect and what risks are taken. When someone says there are no risks, but you give money to me and I will give you lots of money and there's no risk, you should probably be calling a regulatory agency. I'm not a big fan of them, but this is why they exist, to stop people from getting scammed with the wealth without risk concepts. All right, so just a few minutes ago, I spent a lot of time talking about the stupidity being shown by the Obama administration in going after Deutsche Bank. Now that I've done that, just to show you how that I am equal across the board here, that I say that Barack Obama's made some good decisions and some bad ones. He's the lone voice of reason in this Saudi Arabia lawsuit law that was just passed. What are we talking about? 9/11 happened. A lot of the people who did the deed that were the ultimate of scumbags, the ultimate of the worst, that killed a lot of innocent people, were connected in some way or another through payments or through pensions or something with the Saudi Arabian government. The research that was done by the Justice Department at the time and ongoing research today under multiple administrations, both Republican and Democrat, has shown that there was no good evidence against any member of the Saudi Arabian government. There's links to them, but something we have to recognize, just like Social Security exists here, in Saudi Arabia, everybody gets a paycheck from the government. If you're a Saudi citizen, you get a paycheck. You get free college, you get lots of things. That's what our money for their oil is paying for. This is why the stability goes down in Saudi Arabia when oil prices drop, because they have all these entitlements that they've been promising. So anyone who's a Saudi citizen is going to have links to the Saudi government. They're getting paid by them. That's tangential. That's beside the point. This, what you know, that the law went through, it was passed. It says you're allowed, if you're a victim of 9/11, you're allowed to sue the Saudi Arabian government. You're allowed to sue specific members of the Saudi Arabian government. Barack Obama vetoed it. It's the first veto of his career. It's pretty amazing. If you think about that, vetoes, you know, when we talk about him using the executive order pen like he's a dictator, this is his first veto. And it was overridden so universally. 97 senators voted to override the veto. And I think it had more to do with them being shocked that he would ever deem to veto their work than the merits of his veto. Why do I think that he's the voice of reason here when 97 of the people that are supposed to be thinking strategically long-term for us overrode him? Because we have troops in South Korea and in Japan. We have troops in Afghanistan and Iraq, and I realize people don't think we do, but they're there. Not very many. They're there. The reason why we pulled out of Iraq when we did had to do with a status of forces agreement that was not signed by Nur al-Maliki, the president at the time of Iraq, that gave immunity to the U.S. government and to the soldiers of the U.S. government, they're part of the government, from being sued by Iraqi citizens for actions that may or may not have happened in an Iraqi court. We don't have control over what happens in an Iraqi court. The Saudi government doesn't have control over what happens in a U.S. court. Diplomatically, we have immunity in Japan and in South Korea against individual lawsuits against our soldiers because we have a status of forces agreement that says we're not going to sue your governments, you're not going to sue my government over things that are done like this. We'll talk about it, fines will be levied, we'll get it right. When it comes to the 9/11 victims, there's no amount of money that's enough to compensate the family of the 9/11 victims. But we sure gathered a huge amount of money to pay them. A huge amount of money was given by the government and by donors. I was one of those donors. A lot of the people listening were those donors because it was something that touched us to the very core. The reason why the money came out of our pocket and out of the U.S. government pocket is because you couldn't sue the dead terrorists. They didn't have any money. We went and seized all the assets that bin Laden had anywhere and anybody associated with them. That all went to the government. Some of that went into the Victim Relief Fund. If we're setting the precedent by law that we're allowed to sue a foreign government for actions of their citizens, you don't have to have proof to sue. You have to have proof to win the lawsuit. We're saying we're going to sue you in our courts for actions of some of your citizens, and you paid them at some point. The expense associated with that is huge. It's on par, in my mind, and this is, people may say this is extreme, but this is diplomacy. It's on par with the Iranians taking over our embassy. There is an immunity implicit in international law that says our diplomats cannot be punished for things that they do over there because you may be punishing them because you don't like us instead of something that they did. When the Iranians took our embassy and took our diplomats prisoner, it was an affront to the world. It was an affront to us. It was the core of everything that we do diplomatically. You don't touch the diplomat. That's the messenger. We just passed a law that says we're allowed to do it. Don't expect it to be the last law passed saying it. Other countries are going to do it too, and it's going to hurt us a lot more than it hurts Saudi Arabia. In Japan, we have in Okinawa, every year or so, a soldier is arrested and there's a big international incident over rape or assault or something. The Japanese are very concerned about our troops there. Our troops that do the crime are tried under military justice code in the United States courts, not in Japan, because we have a status of forces agreement. If we have troops in Iraq that are in the middle of a firefight and there's a friendly fire incident and we kill an Iraqi, that happens. Do you want that soldier tied up in Iraqi courts for the rest of their life? Because that's the result of that kind of law. So having said Barack Obama makes really dumb decisions, he also makes some pretty smart decisions, just like all of us. Humans are humans, no matter what party they're in. And I'm about out of time for this week. If you'd like to contact my office, our office, off the air, we've got voicemail waiting during the weekend. It's locally 254-947-1111. We give advice to high net worth people, fiduciary advice on how to invest, how to manage businesses, how to keep up with the regulatory environment. The toll-free number is 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. Jeff is hopefully going to be back. Jeff is my dad, and I call him Jeff because when I say my dad, people don't know who I'm talking about sometimes. A lot of people think we're brothers on here, and maybe spiritually. But he should be back at the office soon. He puts out a newsletter every Friday that is on par with any newsletter in the country as far as quality goes. So if you'd like to to email in and get signed up for that newsletter, I highly recommend it. We have a webpage, tpwc.com, as in thepersonalwealthcoach.com. If you'd like to email me directly with a question for the program, my email address is jake@tpwc.com. If you'd like to send well wishes to Jeff, jeff@tpwc.com. Until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
KTM AM Temple Belton Killeen Fort Hood. Proud to broadcast to the largest military post in the free world. News Radio 1400 KTEM.